Buenas tardes. Bien, vamos a reanudar la jornada. La sesión de esta tarde, que lleva el título de Proliferación nuclear, viejas y nuevas amenazas, tenemos con nosotros en la mesa a cuatro personas que reúnen a la vez experiencia profesional, política, en cargos de responsabilidad muy importantes y a la vez una gran actividad académica con publicaciones en importantes revistas relacionadas con el tema de la seguridad y think tanks o instituciones de los más prestigiosos. Son Vladimir Orlov, Bruno Tertre, José María Ridao y Lorenz Kohr. Tenemos los perfiles biográficos de los cuatro con nosotros y simplemente no me parece que sea necesario repetir lo que tenemos todos, ¿no? Que podemos leer perfectamente. A mí me gusta cuando me invitan a un seminario, a una jornada de estas, siempre centrarme en las preguntas, en el guión que envían a los ponentes cuando les invitan, ¿no? Y veo que en la introducción de la presentación del seminario se incluyen tres cuestiones para la mesa de esta tarde. Una, si regresaremos, dice, con el supuesto anterior, que creo que por lo que hemos escuchado y lo que me parece que muchos creemos de los que estamos aquí reunidos, lo de agotada el arma nuclear como método de seguridad global, bueno, como método de seguridad global probablemente estuvo agotada antes de nacer. Quizás para muchos ha sido un instrumento de inseguridad o un mecanismo que ha producido más inseguridad, da igual. Pero lo de agotado, desde luego, no. Y me temo que, como cualquier otra tecnología que haya descubierto el ser humano, es imposible volver dar marcha atrás. En cualquier caso, si regresamos a la disuasión convencional en el marco de equilibrios bilaterales o regionales, creo que es una de las preguntas a las que se respondió en la segunda sesión de esta mañana. Y si nuestros ponentes esta tarde pues quieren volver a ello, pues es su entera libertad. Las otras dos, ¿qué dificultades se plantean hoy en día para la obtención de armas nucleares? Y si podría superarlas una organización terrorista sin el apoyo directo de un Estado que ya posea armas nucleares, me parece que son dos cuestiones esenciales de la seguridad que de forma indirecta o directa se recogen en todos los documentos de estrategias de seguridad nacional y tenemos en el último año tres nuevas, la última estadounidense, la de Francia, la del Reino Unido. Son problemas que están con nosotros. Yo creo que se debatieron mucho y muy intensamente y muy justificadamente después de la caída del Muro de Berlín por la preocupación que había en todo Occidente por lo que pudiera ocurrir con las instalaciones nucleares en la antigua Unión Soviética y con las armas que quedaban dispersadas por algunas de las ex-repúblicas. Posteriormente, con el tema de Al-Qaeda y la entrada en Afganistán, cuando conocimos manuales que se habían descubierto en edificios o en casas por los que habían pasado algunos de los dirigentes de Al-Qaeda sobre el manejo, acceso, intentos de trabajar en el tema nuclear. Y, sin embargo, últimamente no parece que estas cuestiones estén de actualidad. A mí sí que me provoca recuerdos de mi juventud. Yo llegué a Nueva York en el año 75 y recuerdo algunas de las crónicas y reportajes que escribía para el entonces Diario Informaciones de Madrid. Recuerdo una serie que hice sobre el llamado, me parece que el título del libro luego fue The Bomb Kid, el chico bomba, que era un estudiante de segundo de físicas de una universidad del Este, que en un paper que había escrito en segundo de carrera, con documentación del Departamento de Energía y de otros centros de la Administración norteamericana, había demostrado perfectamente cómo se hace la bomba nuclear. Por la misma época, o quizás dos o tres años antes, The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists había publicado también un informe amplio, técnico, científico, de cómo se hacía la bomba nuclear. Les diré que la historia de aquel joven lo pasó tan mal porque le empezaron a vigilar libios, a perseguir coreanos, que el Departamento de Defensa le dio una beca y le fichó para trabajar en laboratorios atómicos importantes de Nuevo México, que es donde yo lo entrevisté en su día. Y seguro que algunos de ustedes recuerdan aquella historia. Bueno, hoy día el problema no es tanto eso, que Corea del Norte persiga, que seguramente también lo haría, a un joven que tenga esos conocimientos. Sé que se restringieron bastante las informaciones a las que se podía acceder en aquellos años, quizás todavía de inocencia, oficialmente, en la administración estadounidense. Se controló mejor ese tipo de información. Pero hoy el problema, evidentemente, son los actores no estatales. Sin más preámbulos y por el orden que tenemos en la agenda, doy la palabra al presidente del Peace Center de Moscú, Vladimir Orlov, cuando usted quiera.
Gracias, Felipe. Buenas tardes. Es una misión imposible. Después de un almuerzo español, tener una sesión más, una discusión sobre las cuestiones de non-proliferación, seguridad nuclear. Pero vamos a ver. Voy a hablar en inglés. I think that we should look, first of all, at just recently happened events, and my friend Miguel helped us a lot this morning when he described the atmosphere and the outcome of the NPT review conference, which took place in just a few weeks ago. I will first look at that, a little bit look at the Russia's position, and I think I will explain to you how I personally see the role of Russia both in non-proliferation of nuclear weapons, nuclear security and nuclear disarmament. And finally, I would identify the key problems for the future, which all of us, both government people, experts, and media and the military, will have to face in the next 3, 4, or 5 years. First of all, as I was in New York for the whole NPT review conference with the Russian delegation, as some of my colleagues here in this room, as Bruno, Tertre, and others, I think we came back to our capitals, at least I can speak for my capital, Moscow, with quite an optimistic mood. The treaty, NPT, once again proved its could survive all the storms. It is still as vital as it was when it was signed in 1968 and entered into force in 1970. And with all the changes in the world, NPT looks like that kind of a global treaty which will be with us forever, if at all there are things in this world which are forever. At least it was extended indefinitely in 1995, and last month in May we saw the proof that all the countries who are members of the treaty recognize the importance of the treaty, recognize that we will base our relationship in accordance with the treaty in its integrity, with the treaty with its three pillars working together, being taken together, which are non-proliferation per se, disarmament, and peaceful uses of nuclear energy. But the result of the conference was not clear until probably 24 hours before it concluded successfully. Two key irritators of the conference were, first, nuclear disarmament, Article 6, and the second, most immediate, is the Middle East. I'm glad we could find a compromise, which stands for all the nations members of the NPT, that we could find a compromise working on the final document, having the list of actions which should be implemented in the years to come. It also demonstrates that the nations are capable to work on a compromise. Nations with very different attitudes to nuclear weapons, to proliferation issues. My country, Russia, actually sometimes has been listed in the negative part of the non-proliferation field. I think this is an unfortunate stereotype, and I'm here not to bring you propaganda for Russia. I work with a private institute. I don't work with the government to offer you another chunk of propaganda. But I want to say that actually this is Russia which advocates, together with the United States, the approach to the world free of nuclear weapons, free from all weapons of mass destruction, much safer world in the future with lower numbers of all weapons. In that sense, this is my president, President Medvedev, who worked together with President Obama on an ambitious goal on cut of strategic nuclear arms, which resulted in the new START treaty, which was signed a few weeks before the NPT review conference started its work in New York. It was signed in Prague. It hopefully will be ratified in the weeks to come in both capitals, Washington and Moscow, though in this time Moscow will not be necessarily the first to hurry up for ratification. We did it naively quite a number of times before, so in this time we probably will do it more or less in parallel with our American counterparts. But hopefully we will have the treaty not only signed but ratified and entered into force soon, and then it will be the most interesting work on preparation for much deeper, more dramatic cuts of nuclear weapons. And I just would like to use this opportunity to assure you all that Russia has its national interest, not romantic interest, but its national interest in going to dramatically lower number of all types of nuclear weapons. This is instruction all of our ministers and agencies receive from the President, Mr. Medvedev, and I'm sure they will be accurate in following those instructions. At the same time, it is true that the way towards lower and lower numbers of nuclear weapons is impossible to achieve overnight. This just doesn't happen in the real world. This should be a step-by-step approach. This should take all security considerations in mind. Of course, it should take the current realities both globally but also in Europe in mind. When you look at the map, you easily can find that this is my country, Russia, which is surrounded by all of those proliferation risk areas, whether it is Iran, whether it is South Asia, whether it is North Korea. It all goes along the border of Russia, along periphery of Russia. Yes, we are concerned about proliferation. This is my country, which borders nature, and which is a major European player, and we're a little bit confused. Certainly, we're not in the times of Cold War any longer, definitely not. We just have new generation of people, new generation of politicians, new generation of business people, new generation of those people who move our countries and nations forward. But we are confused that sometimes we really do see some Cold War stereotypes in Europe so far. And that issue of nuclear weapons in Europe is what we just cannot really understand, cannot really absorb. How can we explain that there are, these years, not in 1980s, today, there are nuclear weapons outside national territories of certain nations, particular one specific nation of the United States, in places as different as Greece or Germany or Turkey? Does those weapons, around 200 tactical nukes, possess any real threat to Russia? Here I may be in disagreement with some of my colleagues. I would say no. No, this is not that threat to my country. But this is a significant question. What do those weapons do in Europe if we talk about new strategic relationships? We look very positively when we hear from the leader of NATO, from the Secretary General, some very helpful, visional proposals on dialogue between Russia and NATO. Then it even more contradicts when somebody tells us, look, we have those nukes not for the military purpose, but to bring together our alliance for some political reason, because some Poles and some others just feel more secure as they politically have it. I just think this is old thinking. This is definitely not will move us all forward. On nuclear disarmament, at my institute at Peer Center, we produced so-called papel blanco or white paper on our NPT 2010 with some analysis and recommendations. I believe that there are at least seven immediate steps which should be done now, today, on the area of nuclear disarmament. Some of them were more or less reflected in the final document on the NPT conference, not all of them for obvious reasons. First step should be that nuclear weapon states undertake not to increase their nuclear arsenals. Yeah, it may sound surprising for some people here. Neither France, nor Britain, nor Russia, nor United States think of increases of their nuclear arsenals. We think how dramatic should be decreases. We think even of nuclear zero sometimes. But don't forget that my country, Russia, is not only a European nation, though it is a European nation. It is also Asian nation. And when we have our strategic partner, but also our neighbor, People's Republic of China, which is capable to double its nuclear arsenal in a very short period of time and never made any commitments to lower levels of nuclear weapons, then it's concern of my country to make sure that neither of nuclear five increases its nuclear arsenal. Then we really feel much more relief in going to lower levels. Second, nuclear weapon states commit not to station their nuclear weapons outside their national territories, neither strategic nor non-strategic. Three, nuclear weapon states agree not to develop new sophisticated types of nuclear weapons. Number four, Russia and the United States ensure prompt ratification of the START treaty. I think this is one of the most immediate and most practical and realistic tasks in the list. Number five, all nuclear weapon states launch the work on a new treaty that would ban the placement of weapons in outer space. Here, unfortunately, we don't see as much enthusiasm from the US side as we see in other areas. I certainly do not want to see for my country to work hard on nuclear reductions on land and see arms race in outer space. And the sixth step is intermediate range and shorter range nuclear forces treaty, INF treaty, which is currently bilateral, Russian-US, should become multilateral, particularly including all countries which have nuclear weapons, but not limited to them. And the seventh step is that both Russia, United States, European nations, and other major players should commit themselves to reduce military budgets, military expenditure. It is so unfortunate and so shameful that the financial crisis didn't teach all of us any lesson about better expenditure. It could be, maybe still can be, a very good momentum in trying to cut dramatically not only expenditure devoted to nukes, though nukes included, but also to other types of weapons. I believe that this is what international community should have on the agenda for the months and years to come. It is true that other issues are on the list, and Miguel, Bruno, myself, and others were working on the final document and the NPT review conference, which is quite a nice, quite a good compromise. And it includes language also on transparency of nuclear weapons. Not all of us maybe are equally prepared to deal with transparency of nuclear weapons right away, but it should be our agenda for the near future. Reporting on our nuclear weapons, on the numbers of capabilities, this is all important tasks. Vicente showed us this morning an interesting map, an interesting chart with the figures. There were some issues I wanted to argue with, including indication of offensive biological weapon program in Russia, which I myself currently is unaware of, so there are some issues to look at. But also some numbers which 14,000 nuclear weapons in Russia, or 14,000 nuclear weapons in Russia all in all, which very likely is a huge exaggeration. But I agree that if we look at all types of nuclear weapons, transparency should take its place, and reporting both on the qualities and on the numbers should be there. And of course, all countries with nuclear weapons, both nuclear five as well as such responsible players as India, I would say six, five plus India, should work on reducing roles of nuclear weapons in their national strategies and nuclear doctrines. More specifically for Europe, I know that tactical nuclear weapons issue will be popping up here and there, both in the media, in the academic discussions, in the military-to-military discussions. And I think this is quite fair, because there are also tactical, there are also nuclear weapons as well as other types. But I suggest that it would be counterproductive to just take that because, oh, it's so sexy to discuss TNW, let's do it, to grab it, take it out of the whole agenda. Instead, I suggest a holistic agenda for European security matters, Let's discuss all issues which are of concern of my country, of European Union, of other countries, of other players in Europe, including United States, all together. Tactical nuclear weapons should be part of the package. Of course, after United States does its job to withdraw its weapons outside territories of other, its national territories. CFE, Strategic Forces, Conventional Forces Treaty in Europe. Where there is that treaty? How many countries ratified, adopted treaty? Whether it's more alive or dead? I think it's quite an important issue for all Europe, including my country. We are ready to discuss it. We are ready either to start from scratch, maybe it will be easier, or to make our work towards implementation of the agreements. And here we can work in different groupings. We can take discussions between bilateral Russia, EU, Russia, United States, but also trilateral Russia, EU, US, as well as other forums. Russia's concern is missile defense, defensive missile systems. So far, we're satisfied how the new U.S. administration, or not as new, deals with this issue. I understand they think of money of U.S. taxpayers when they stopped development of the system, elements of the system in Czech Republic and Poland. That's good for the U.S. Taxpayers, definitely. But how much can I be sure? What are the U.S. plans for their missile defense are? When I look at the U.S. doctrinal documents on that, I'm not sure what their plans are. I have no problem with working together with the United States, with Europe, with NATO, on non-strategic our missile defense. It's in our common interest. Strategic missile defense may hurt the global security, and in that sense, we should have clear assurances that the U.S. plans do not go beyond non-strategic systems, which I don't have. In fact, at the NPT review conference just a few weeks ago, we had some purists from certain European nations, not from Spain, who told us, look, there was a document, 13 steps of nuclear disarmament adopted in the year 2000. They just take it, copy-paste it for today. I said, okay, I'm in favor. Don't forget, though, that in the document of 2000, there was a special point, a special step, which indicated that ABM treaty is a cornerstone of international security. That was not my country who abrogated ABM treaty. And some of you probably already forgot what ABM treaty is, which indicates that really the situation develops quite quickly. One more point here on the European security. This is a European security treaty. This is an idea proposed by Russia. The draft was proposed by the Russian Federation. It has been considered by certain nations and groupings, including NATO, OSCE, and others. And this is the first draft, if you like. This is the zero draft. I think if we talk about exchanges of our concerns and common visions of Europe, cooperative visions of European security, then probably we need to work together on these new approaches towards European security. And tactical nuclear weapons is only one small element on building new architecture of European security. The old architecture has gone. We had transitional system, which worked, más o menos, but now it definitely is different timing. It's not necessary just to take whatever Russian proposal includes. Let's criticize it, let's discuss it. In places like Madrid, I find it much more fruitful discussion. In Paris, we have very useful, though sometimes difficult discussions. But we understand, we realize that European mechanisms are more complicated. Still, we believe it is important to look at European security architecture in a holistic way, not grabbing the subject some of us like or dislike and either add it to the soup or take it out of the soup. One more point I wanted to raise is the Middle East. This probably has been the most painful, was the most painful issue, has been the most painful issue, and will be the most painful issue for the nuclear non-proliferation agenda. While we all looked positively at the dynamic of the U.S. administration on the nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation issues, I was disappointed at how U.S. delegation at the conference behaved in regard to the Middle East. Reluctance until the very last hours of the conference to include mentioning of Israel in the final document, for me, has been very harmful. Whether we have vision or not on how we should move on the Middle East, I'm not sure. We in Russia do. We in Russia believe that there should be immediate steps implemented in regard to the Israeli nuclear arsenal in the Middle East. I know this is not the most overt topic, but without it, we probably will not be able to address the whole situation. The Israeli nuclear arsenal, reluctance of Israel to provide any transparency, at least a minimal openness of its Dimona facility to the IAEA inspectors, contradicts both the spirit of the time and the need for the strengthening of the nuclear non-proliferation regime. I don't believe that the situation will be sustainable if the current Israeli government will continue behaving like it behaves now. Iran is another major topic. By the year 2012, we should have Middle East conference related to the zone free of all weapons of mass destruction and delivery systems in the Middle East. This is in the final document of the 2010 conference. So far, we know that Israel, at least its current government, is uninterested in participating. Iranians tell us that they will not participate if Zionist regime is present at the conference. We may have a very frustrating situation when two nations which have either nuclear weapons or nuclear capabilities in the region will be out of that potentially very important conference. Having said that, I believe that countries like Spain play a very special role in both official and informal dialogue with the Middle Eastern partners. And we in Russia would like to use your strength, guys, and your connections, and also our connections, is trying to build the atmosphere by the year 2012, which should be favorable, not only to have a conference because it is required by this document, but a conference with a positive result. I also understand that we have two more years to come, and both governments change by that time and situations change by that time. I would also like to highlight that by that time, in 2 years from now, we will have quite a different situation in the Middle East related to the nuclear energy, peaceful nuclear energy. As of today, every nation of the Middle East, every Arab nation, except for only one, for Lebanon, explicitly stated that it would develop, or it already starts developing, its peaceful nuclear energy programs. This is a completely new economic and strategic situation. We should work together are, particularly with our colleagues from Southern Europe, from Spain, on assessing this situation, on being prepared for that. And the final point I will make, and then we'll stop. We can only run. If there are questions, I will be more than happy to respond. Relates to the nuclear security, what Felipe mentioned in his introductory remarks. State actors and non-state actors. I think that still, in non-proliferation area, the main threat comes from state actors. I have been dealing with non-state actors and their nuclear threat for around 15 years. And my conclusion is that we have very few actors, non-state actors, which have real capability in getting unauthorized access to nuclear materials or nuclear munitions. Having said that, our key attention still should be aimed at state actors. I must confess that I have areas in the world which worry me a lot from the standpoint of that connection of state and non-state actors and nuclear proliferation. Number one, number two, and number three concern is the same. This is Pakistan. Americans pump up money in Pakistan and its nuclear security upgrades. But I'm not certain that Pakistan has its nuclear security as adequate as it should. We didn't use momentum of the nuclear security summit for that. I believe we should use the momentum later on to work on Pakistan quite attentively. Thank you very much.
Thank you. El segundo en la lista de ponentes de hoy es Bruno Tertre. De su biografía que tiene ahí, yo destaco sobre todo los muchos años que trabajó en el Ministerio de Defensa como Special Assistant to the Director of Strategic Affairs. Bruno, cuando quieras.
Thank you very much, Chairman. I'd like to thank the organizers and sponsors, in particular the Spanish government. And I'd like to actually to acknowledge the excellent contribution made by chair of the European Union during the New York NPT conference. It was a very difficult job that Ambassador Aguirre Garcia had, but I can testify that he did a very, very good job. And I'm even more comfortable to say that because he's not present anymore, but I made the point to him in private too. Let me tackle the topic that I was actually, you know, assigned to us in the program, that is proliferation, state proliferation, and terrorist use. Let me use the old but very always useful device of the good news and bad news, because I think it's actually quite appropriate for this topic. Let me make the good news first, 5 points. One is very simple. I think that proliferation has been contained. Contained first as compared to the dire provisions of the mid-1960s, precisely because of these provisions, a global norm was set up, which is the NPT, largely through efforts, the combined efforts of the United States and the Soviet Union, but also through exports control after the Indian nuclear tests, which made it almost impossible for industrialized nations to export technologies useful to make weapon-grade plutonium. And a third reason why it was contained is that the West, and in particular the United States here again, made sure to extend credible security guarantees to states that otherwise would have been tempted to make their own nuclear weapons. Proliferation has been contained also when one looks back at the equally dire provisions that were done at the end of the Cold War, around the years 1989-1992, the end of the Cold War did not bring more proliferation as compared to what some famous authors such as John Mersheimer feared. And the breakup of the Soviet Union did not lead to loss of control on weapons and fissile material, thanks in part, by the way, to Western assistance. So proliferation has been contained. Another piece of good news is that the detection capabilities, both of key Western nations and also of international agencies, I'm speaking about the International Atomic Energy Agency, are much better equipped now to deal with proliferation issues than they were only 20 years ago. I mean, the national level satellite imagery has evolved to a point that you can actually use even public imagery to make some useful searches about proliferation problems. But also the role of the IAEA more recently has evolved considerably to the point that, you know, from being accountants, they're becoming detectives, so to say. As a result, in our collective ability to detect proliferation has considerably improved as compared to what it was only 20 years ago. The third piece of good news I'd like to share is that, contrary to what has been said earlier on and to what is suggested in the program, I don't believe for a second that Pakistan today is a major proliferation risk. I will indulge myself in saying that I'm fairly familiar with the Pakistani system, including the nuclear complex. And frankly, as much as one can be severe with the Pakistani complicities with the AQ Khan network, I actually like to call it not the AQ Khan network, but the network of Pakistani origin, I don't think it would be fair to say that there is today a severe proliferation risk coming from Pakistan. The deliberate transfer of nuclear weapons or fissile material today is completely out of the question. The control of nuclear weapons and fissile material is today, emphasized today. I'm not speaking for what happened 20 years ago or what could happen in 20 years, but is today very well assured. I spare the risk of an Islamist takeover, quote-unquote. Only those who have absolutely no familiarity with Pakistani political culture and the way the politics of this country are being run could think that this is a serious risk. This is not a serious risk. There are risks regarding Pakistan. In 5, 10, 20 years from now, you know, the deliquescence of the state is a real possibility. But to say that today Pakistan runs, you know, is actually worse of these nightmarish scenarios that one sees in the media all the time, including the French media, by the way. I don't think it's just serious. The fourth and final piece of good news that I'd like to share is that if you are a terrorist group, it's very, very, very difficult to build nuclear weapons, as those of you who are familiar with nuclear technology already know. It remains a fact that access to fissile material has proven to be, so far at least, an insurmountable barrier. Of course, it's easy to have the know-how and ability to construct a, you know, large, rugged device which has a reasonable chance of producing a 1 to 2 kiloton yield. But it's a very different thing to make a transportable device. And again, the main barrier here is really the access to fissile materials. So I don't think that nuclear terrorism today is a risk that is worth the extraordinary amount of intellectual, financial, and technological efforts that some countries are bringing in. I'm not saying it's inexistent. I'm just saying that in terms of cost effectiveness of where we should put our money, I'm not sure that dealing with the risk of nuclear terrorism should be an absolute priority. Now, that was the good news. Now, the bad news. As far as proliferation is concerned, there is a market. There is a supply and there is a demand. Therefore, there is a market. So the drivers for nuclear proliferation continue to exist. On the demand side, you still have, as has been the case since 1945, you both have status-driven demand and security-driven demand. I don't think that the P5's nuclear weapons are really a key problem or a key driver here. I mean, the history of nuclear programs shows that, generally speaking, at least in the past 30 years, it has been, you know, the Western conventional superiority has been much more of a proliferation driver than, you know, how many nuclear weapons the United States or Russia has. There's demand, there's also the supply. There is the legacy of that network that I earlier on called the network of Pakistani origin. And unfortunately, that legacy is ours for a long time. And if you are a government, it has become much easier than it was the case 20 years ago to make fissile material, or at least to embark in a uranium enrichment program. The technology is widely available, and it's very easy, unfortunately, to hide a nuclear enrichment plant. It will be even worse if the technology of enrichment by laser actually develops, as some fear. Another part of the legacy of the network is that one, possibly two, and even possibly three weapons designs have been transferred by private actors to, or maybe not so private actors, to other states. One design of Chinese origin and one, possibly two, designs of Pakistani origin. And if these designs fall in the hands, as possibly is already the case, of states such as Iran, then their job to make nuclear weapons becomes much easier. The supply is also still there because of a new supplier. North Korea has become a new supplier. And like many analysts, I was surprised by the construction of a reactor ideally suited for the production of weapon-grade plutonium by North Korea in Syria. That was really bad news, because that meant that another state, after Pakistan, has proven willing and able to transfer sensitive nuclear technology to other states. The second bad news is that not only is Iran at the nuclear threshold now, but if history is any guide, it will cross the threshold. Iran is at the threshold because, well, at least according to my definition of a threshold, and I certainly would grant that not everybody has the same definition of what it is to be at the nuclear threshold. But the facts are that Iran today has enough low-enriched uranium for approximately two nuclear bombs if converted to highly enriched uranium, has now started to enrich to 20%, and 20% is almost 90%. For those of you who are not familiar with enrichment, it goes like this. It's an exponential curve. Once you are at 20%, you are almost at 90%. So your job is practically done. Iran has done some extensive work on weaponization and has developed reentry vehicles that are able to carry nuclear weapons. Now, if history is any guide, Iran will go all the way. Why am I saying that? Because no country has ever reached the threshold without crossing it. Or countries that reach the threshold don't stay at the threshold. Well, you can argue with some past cases, such as India in 74, but India in 74 had not yet worked on weaponization. So I'm very, very skeptical when I hear experts or government officials saying, I know what Iran wants. What do you know? Iran does not want a weapon. Iran wants the capability. Says who? Says who? How do you know better than the Iranians exactly what they want? You know, I'm not into the Iranians. I'm not into Khamenei's mind. Good for me. So I don't know what they want. But I'm saying again that if history is any guide, they will go all the way. And I'm not even sure Iran knows what it wants. I mean, look, again, history. There's a country I'm pretty familiar with, which is my own, France, which arrived at the threshold without ever having decided to build the bomb. Just by a series of incremental small steps, we arrived at the threshold in 1958. without having ever made a strategic decision to build the bomb. Now, then came the goal, and then it was a different ball game. Let me say a few words about a topic that was discussed this morning, which is Iran and Israel. And let me give you four reasons why I think these are very, very different cases, strategic, technical, and political. First reason is that Iran is a cheater and a threat to the integrity of the non-proliferation regime. Israel, by staying out of the regime, has admitted implicitly that it wants nuclear weapons, just like India did. Now, you can say that the NPT is a good or bad treaty, a just or unjust treaty, but it's the state of international law, and you can't compare a cheater with someone who has decided to stay out of the treaty. The second reason for me is a political judgment, I think an informed one, which is that Iran is today a quasi-military dictatorship with strong regional ambitions. And the last time I checked, it would be very difficult to qualify Israel this way. The third reason, and one which is sometimes missed by some commentators, is that Iran is considered a much bigger threat than Israel. I mean, Iran's potential bomb, is a much bigger deal for the Arab states than Israel's bomb. Israel's bomb has been in existence for more than 40 years, and it has not produced proliferation. And as those of you who travel to the Middle East and the Gulf today would know very well, Iran's bomb is likely to lead to more proliferation. Finally, the fourth difference is obvious, is that one state does not acknowledge the existence of the other, while the other does acknowledge the existence of the former. So all in all, I think this comparison between Iran and Israel for me is frankly very difficult to accept. Now, if Iran goes nuclear, then the cascading effect will be real, even though I think it would be very slow. It will not be automatic, and it will not be this immediate cascade of nuclear program. I think it will be a slow motion process. But the real one, and that's my third piece of bad news, Egypt is, for all intents and purposes, by far the most likely to go nuclear after Iran because it has the status motivation, it has the security motivations, and it has a lot of technical know-how. Who comes next after Egypt may be a country which has been traditionally of interest to both Spain and France, and of course I'm talking about Algeria. It's very, very difficult for me. Now, we're not talking about the next 5 years, okay? We're talking hypothetical of a cascade. But for anyone who is familiar with the relationship between Egypt and Algeria, would see very clearly that it would be extraordinarily difficult for Algiers to accept that Egypt becomes the Arab nuclear state without reacting. And the sensitivity of this debate is enormous in Algeria, and I can personally testify to that because having written about this this possibility, I was vilified by the Algerian press to the point that actually this triggered a statement by a minister responsible for nuclear matters in Algeria, who said that Algeria does intend to ratify the additional protocol, which was good news for me, except that they have been saying that for the past 6 years now. And as Vladimir can testify, because we were both in New York in our respective official delegations, the Algerians were among that small group of countries which was very vocal in opposing the additional protocol. That's going to be my final piece of bad news, which is about the NPT RevCon in New York. I think that what happened in New York showed that it's very difficult to reinforce the non-proliferation norm in a way which is acceptable to 189 countries. It proved extraordinarily difficult to make it automatic to refer violations to the UN Security Council, to make states accountable for their past violations if they withdraw from the treaty, and even more to make it the additional protocol a universal norm. I think we have seen in New York, I've seen in New York really the limitations of multilateral diplomacy by consensus. It's a bit, little bit like Copenhagen, if you want. I think there is a limit, an inherent limit to what you can achieve when you seek consensus among 190 countries on the key issues such as, you know, climate change or nuclear matters. So to conclude, I would say that the most likely scenario, despite the good news that I've mentioned, or because of them, the most likely scenario for nuclear proliferation is a slow motion process of more proliferation and nuclear hedging, as they say. That is, states take their precautionary measures to make them able to go nuclear one day if they wanted to. It's not going to be a fast process. You're not going to see, if Iran goes nuclear, immediately five more nuclear countries. This is not going to happen. This is, by the way, this is also probably impossible from a technical point of view. But that slow motion cascading effect will exist. And on the terrorism side, on the non-state actor side, I would say that, from my point of view, radiological terrorism, or dirty bombs, as they say, is much, much more probable than nuclear terrorism. I think we will see one day, I mean, in the coming years, a successful act of radiological terrorism. Although we can debate why this has not happened yet, despite a couple of cases in Russia. So let us refrain from the most pessimistic scenarios in these matters. But after all, even my not-so-pessimistic scenarios should be pessimistic enough to do something about them. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you very much. De la biografía de Lawrence Kohr, yo destacaría, como citaba siempre, los cargos de responsabilidad política que han llegado a tener, responsabilidad profesional en la Administración, el puesto de Assistant Secretary of Defense de 1981 a 1985, y luego sus trabajos, el que tiene en estos momentos el Center for American Progress, pero previamente en el Council of Foreign Relations, en la Brookings, en la Universidad de Pittsburgh y en la American Enterprise Institute. Cuando quieras, Lawrence.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. And people talking about Spain's role in dealing with nuclear weapons. People forget that during the Cold War, we had a few submarines at a place called Rota, which I'm sure our friends from Russia had thought about when they were figuring where to send their nuclear weapons. And we were always very grateful for that, because I think that that helped an awful lot in us sending the message to the Soviet Union about the steadfastness of NATO. When you get an American to talk, usually you get a joke. I tried out this joke with the translator. He said it would go over well, but we have a different translator now, I see back there. So, but let me try anyway. And it's about this couple who had been married for several years, and to say the least, the passion had gone out of the romance. But they decided to take a trip to the Holy Land. While they were there, unfortunately, the man passed away, and the woman was faced with the problem of what to do with the body. Well, someone in the Holy Land said, well, you can bury your husband here for 50 euros. And she looked and she said, how much would it cost to send him home? Oh, he said, at least 5,000 euros. She said, I think I'll send him home. The man looked at her and said, that doesn't make any sense. She said, well, let me tell you what I'm thinking. I heard that years ago, a man was buried here, and 3 days later, he rose from the dead. And I figured, why take a chance? A lot of people talk about Obama's Prague speech. Well, let me read you a quotation. My dream is to see the day when nuclear weapons will be banished from the face of the earth. That was not Obama in Prague. That was the president I had the privilege of working for, Ronald Reagan, in 1984. And when Ronald Reagan concluded the INF Treaty with the then Soviet Union, he was characterized by members of his own party who established the Anti-Appeasement Alliance to oppose ratification, and they ran newspaper ads comparing Gorbachev to Hitler and Reagan to Neville Chamberlain. George Will, the conservative commentator, in talking about the INF agreement, said that, and I quote, "Reagan has elevated wishful thinking to the status of a political philosophy." And my point here is, when people talk about Obama and say how different he is and he comes from a different tradition, that's not true. For example, the first president to talk about the United States not using nuclear weapons against non-nuclear states was Dwight Eisenhower in 1957. Let me also read you a quote that has to do with the use of nuclear weapons, and we discussed it this morning. And it says, and I quote, "I came to the realization that nuclear weapons had little utility. When I realized that even if Saddam Hussein had used a nuclear weapon on us, we would have to retaliate on a conventional basis." And that was General Charles Horner, who was the Allied force commander in the first Persian Gulf War. So when people talk about the fact that Obama is somehow different and he's changed things, no, he's very much in keeping the tradition of American presidents. Now, let me make one other point here before I talk about what Obama inherited in these areas, some of the things he's done or maybe has not done. Thomas this morning mentioned that the study was done that said the United States only needed 331 nuclear weapons to guarantee deterrence. That study was not done by some liberal think tank. That study was done by the Air War College, which is the group that's responsible for developing the doctrine for the United States government when it comes to nuclear weapons. Now, Bruno mentioned, and I think quite correctly, that up to 2000, things seem to be going pretty well. But from the point of view of the United States, the first 8 years of that decade, when it comes to the subject we're discussing here, were, in my view, a disaster. The United States got out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which made it very difficult for us then to complain about North Korea renouncing the Non-Proliferation Treaty. We deployed, or it's talked about deploying national missile defense in Eastern Europe, which we said was no threat to Russia. When I speak to some of my Russian colleagues, they said, "What would you think if we put a similar system in Canada or Mexico?" And in my view, the whole thing was absurd, because you were deploying a system that wasn't working against a threat that didn't exist in countries that did not want it. Neither the Polans nor the Czechoslovakia people wanted it. We basically had to put terrible pressure on them. In 2004, we announced that we would not get involved with the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, that we would not allow the verification. And even our British allies were saying they just didn't understand that position. We refused to get involved in developing a protocol for the Biological Weapons Convention. We have a biological weapons treaty, but you need a protocol to see how you're going to be enforce it. The administration announced it would not send the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty to the Senate, that it was a flawed treaty, and in fact unsigned the treaty, which had never been done in our history. Funding for what we call the Nunn-Lugar, or the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program that we've talked about here in terms of securing loose nukes, was actually cut. It was reduced during that period of time. The administration talked about developing a new nuclear weapon, a bunker buster. But again, when you're telling other people not to be going nuclear, developing a new nuclear weapon undermine our authority. Now, Just as an aside, we were very lucky that that weapon did not get funded. It was an accident, because our Armed Services Committees, then under the control of the Republicans, had authorized it, money was appropriated, and you had a Republican legislator from Ohio who was the chair of the Energy and Water Subcommittee. And in our government, we never get the budget done on time, and Christmas we send the whole thing up and nobody gets a chance to read it. They all want to go home for the holidays, who took it out. Nobody noticed it. And he was a Republican congressman by the name of David Hobson from Ohio. We signed a nuclear deal with India. Now, what message does that send? You don't ratify, you don't become part of the NPT, you develop nuclear weapons, but you get the same benefits. And I'll talk later about the impact of that on Pakistan. Now, we talked a lot about Iran. Let me give you something from my own background in dealing with the Iranians. As you know, the United States does not have diplomatic relations with Iran. However, they do have an embassy in New York because they are represented at the United Nations. Back in 2001, I was the vice president of the Council on Foreign Relations. And there's a theory among a lot of people that the council has a lot more influence than it does. I tell you that because shortly after 2001, I got a call from the Iranian ambassador. And he said, I'd like to invite you, and I was running the research division there, and your colleagues who specialize in our area to come over for dinner. So I went over with a group of my colleagues. During the dinner, the ambassador made it very clear that they were with us in Afghanistan. And if you remember, there were actually candlelight vigils in Tehran after that attack. Why did they do it? They didn't like the Taliban either. They'd be more than happy to help us. And in the Bonn conference at 2001, the end of 2001, where we set up Karzai in power, James Dobbins, Ambassador Dobbins, who was Bush's representative, told me that without the Iranian help, that conference would not have been a success. January 2002, President Bush puts him on the axis of evil. The ambassador calls me up again, this time no dinner, basically saying, what is going on? And if you take a look at that, the axis of evil, you look at the national security strategy, which comes out shortly after, and talks about not preemption, and everybody misunderstands this. It's called preventive war, which says that the United States reserves the right to go to war against a country that could be a potential threat. They would take it on themselves. Go back and look. They never used the term that Iraq was an immediate threat. So it was a doctrine of preventive war. And the president also said, I've got to go to Iraq before they get nuclear weapons. Well, what kind of message does that send to the next country on the axis of evil list? At the 2005 NPT review conference, who did we send? I'll bet you nobody in this room can remember, because it was a nobody. We didn't send the Secretary of State. We sent a comparatively low-level official to that. And then, of course, since we were wrong about Iraq having nuclear weapons, why would we have credibility when we were talking about other countries like Iran and North Korea? And then finally, we tried to prevent El Baradei, the head of the IAEA, from getting reappointed because we didn't like what he said about Iraq not having nuclear weapons before the invasion. Now, this is what Obama inherited. Now, he's done some very good things in moving along the agenda we're speaking about today. First of all, it's been mentioned, the Prague speech. Now, one can disagree or call it naive, but if you go back and you look at the quotes I've given you, this is very much in the tradition of, I would say, the presidents who did the most in dealing with these weapons. His non-proliferation, his nuclear posture review basically reiterated what Eisenhower said. We will not use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear states who keep to the terms of the NPT. The START agreement has been mentioned. And I think in terms of ICAD, you said two-thirds reduction is 80% reduction now in the number of nuclear weapons between the United States and former Soviet Union, and now Russia. We talked about the conference that he convened in Washington of all the countries to talk about the question of proliferation. And things came up with that, I think most people were amazed, that there's nuclear materials in Latin America that people haven't secured. So I think he got the attention on that. Who did he send to the NPT review conference? The Secretary of State. Secretary of State Clinton went and gave a speech that Vladimir said it was a little bit late, but did talk about the Middle East being a nuclear-free zone. He reached out to Iran and said he would negotiate with them without preconditions. Remember that in the previous administration, the condition was you stop enriching your uranium. And I'm thinking to myself, what are you going to negotiate about? It would be like if we entered into the arms control agreements with the Soviets and said, well, you have to get rid of all your nuclear weapons before we talk, okay? That's what you needed to negotiate. He decided not to put those missiles and radars into Poland and the Czech Republic. The Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, the funding was increased, as well as expanded. It's not just dealing with the Soviet Union or former Soviet states, but it goes beyond this. Now, those were the good things, but it's not a perfect record. There are some things that he's done that I think have weakened the case for dealing with the question of proliferation. First of all, he's reinforced the deal with India. Now, I can tell you, I spent a month in Pakistan. That does not go over well. The Pakistanis are developing more nuclear material because of that agreement. And by the way, from an American point of view, we got taken to the cleaners. In fact, Michael Crapon at the Stimson Center in Washington uses this term, the gift that keeps on taking, okay, in terms of what we have got or not got. He had, in order to get the START agreement passed, some people in the Republican Party who are not in the tradition of Reagan and Eisenhower, he's had to increase spending on keeping our capacity to develop nuclear weapons alive. The increase in that budget this year, in a year of fiscal austerity, is 13%. In his nuclear posture review, there were loopholes in there. Because he talked about, well, we could resume testing, and if a country gets biological or chemicals, we may rethink about it. He has not sent up the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty or the Fissile Material Control Treaty to the Senate for ratification, and given what's likely to happen at the 2010 election, it's going to be very hard to get 67 votes, which you need to approve a treaty in the United States. He's also increased the budget for missile defense, and they're now talking about putting something in Romania. And then finally, our defense spending, even though we have the severe financial crisis, our defense spending in real terms, that's to say after inflation, is still projected to go up over the next 5 years, and that's after 13 consecutive years of real increases. Now, let me conclude by saying a couple of words about Iran and Pakistan, the subjects of proliferation. Somehow, after 9/11, the United States, or people in the United States, forgot about the traditional doctrines of international politics, that somehow or another, after 9/11, containment and deterrence no longer could work. I don't know if Iran's going to get a nuclear weapon, where they're going to stop or not stop, but I can tell you this. If we start, and I'll speak for the United States particularly, making statements, we will not let Iran get a nuclear weapon, and then they do, you either got to take drastic action or your credibility is getting undermined. We said the same thing about North Korea. I think we have to say Iran is a rational country. Remember, they settled the war with Iraq with the status quo ante, even though Iraq had attacked them and used chemical weapons. So to say that these people are completely, you know, irrational doesn't make sense. In terms of other countries getting that, We talked this morning about extended deterrence. If we could keep the Japanese and South Korea from developing nuclear weapons, there's no reason why we can't do that in the Gulf. And then finally, I think if we're patient, if you look at the situation in Iran, I think they're where Poland was in the early 1980s. Nobody would have predicted what would happen. But given the fact that the legitimacy of the Islamic Republic is being undermined by the way that they conducted the election, the best thing we can do is be patient. The worst thing we can do is say, we're not going to let you get a nuclear weapon and we're going to do something, because if there's one thing that unites all of the Iranians, it's their right to develop nuclear weapons. And as I mentioned this morning in a question to Vincent here, if you go back and you read, when China developed a nuclear weapon, Mao Zedong said something to the effect, and I'm not translating exactly, let's have a nuclear exchange. Bring it on. We'll lose a couple of hundred million people. We'll still have a billion. How about you? And if you get the tapes of Lyndon Johnson, okay, the tapes are available, they actually talked about taking out China's nuclear weapons. Well, we didn't. We live with it, and China then became an ally of ours in helping to end the Cold War. Pakistan. After my visit to Pakistan, I'm reasonably confident that those weapons are not going to fall into the wrong hands, because the Pakistani army, and remember, you know, most countries have an army. Pakistan is an army that has a country. Basically, they see that as the great equalizer in dealing with India, because they don't have the conventional forces. And while you might say they shouldn't be worried about India, the fact of the matter is they're worried about India. So I think that they're going to be very, very, you know, careful to make sure that those don't fall into the wrong hands. Now, let me conclude with another statement here about, as I say, the president I had the privilege of serving. Today's conservatives have conjured up a mythic Reagan who never compromised with America's enemies and never shrunk from a fight. But the real Reagan did both of those things, and in fact, they were a big part of his success. Thank you very much.
Muchísimas gracias. La verdad es que me ha provocado un montón de recuerdos. Yo estuve en la negociación de Ginebra de Baker con Tarek Aziz, en la que le entrega la carta supuestamente para el presidente Saddam Hussein, y Tarek Aziz la mira, le mira. Esta no es una carta, esto no se hace en diplomacia. Pero luego Tarek Aziz nos cuenta lo que ha leído, ¿no? Y dice que le amenazaba, no decía armas nucleares, pero sí con usar todos los medios a disposición de los Estados Unidos si Saddam Hussein llegaba, se atrevía a utilizar armas de destrucción masiva. Y luego, cuando ya empieza el día 17 de enero la invasión, la Fuerza Aérea, y empiezan a prepararse las operaciones terrestres, recuerdo a alguno de los mandos británicos que es que nos lo decía, no dormía, obsesionado por lo que podía pasar, sobre todo en la bolsa de la parte occidental del sur, por donde pensaban hacer la entrada rodeando por detrás, porque no veían tanques iraquíes y estaban seguros de que probablemente era porque pensaban utilizar allí armas, ¿no? A mí esas experiencias o esos recuerdos, cuando se refería ahora nuestro compañero, el profesor Lawrence Kohr, a la cantidad de errores, realmente son fundamentales para entender lo que ha pasado hoy. Y quiero dar las gracias por una cosa. A mí siempre me han encantado, como periodista ahora, no hablo como profesor de Relaciones Internacionales, los que son capaces de hacer una crítica rigurosa de lo que hace su propio país. Y siempre sospecho de los que nunca critican a sus propios países. Lo siento, es un defecto profesional del periodismo. Bueno, en el caso de José María Ridao, viene de la diplomacia, ha tenido destinos en Angola, la Unión Soviética, antes de Delfín de la URSS, Guinea Ecuatorial, Francia y la UNESCO. Y es uno de los pocos diplomáticos, no es el único, pero sí de los pocos, que luego han dejado la diplomacia por la literatura, aunque en el 2006 el trabajo en la UNESCO fue un retorno temporal. Y tengo aquí apuntados, me parece que de la página de internet, al menos 10 libros publicados ya. Cuando quieras, José María.
Muchas gracias, Felipe. Yo creo que en las intervenciones que me han precedido se ha ejemplificado el problema al que nos enfrentamos con la proliferación. Y es que, justamente, como decía Terje, Bruno, no todo el mundo interpreta las amenazas de igual manera. No todo el mundo considera las mismas amenazas. Por consiguiente, eso nos coloca en una situación, cuando miramos el desarrollo que está teniendo el dossier nuclear en los últimos tiempos, nos coloca ante una situación, digo, en la que lo prioritario sería justamente hacer un análisis compartido de esas amenazas. Si todos consideramos que las amenazas son diferentes, probablemente a lo que lleguemos es a errores de apreciación, a errores que generan nueva proliferación, como ha puesto de manifiesto el profesor Korb. Yo creo que si nos detenemos en hacer ese análisis del marco de referencia de acuerdo con el cual tratamos de analizar las amenazas, que son amenazas reales, veremos que hay una serie de equívocos, por un lado, y de decisiones previas al análisis que conviene poner sobre la mesa. Yo creo que en el terreno de los equívocos se encuentra, sin duda, lo que podríamos llamar el síndrome de Macbeth. La idea de que what's done is done, puesto que tenemos una capacidad nuclear, puesto que sabemos que existe el armamento nuclear, no se puede hacer nada, lo que se ha inventado no puede desinventarse. Y digo que es un equívoco en varios sentidos. Es un equívoco porque efectivamente muchas veces no se trata de hacer frente a hechos que son irreversibles, sino a los efectos de esos hechos, y es ahí donde tiene sentido la diplomacia y es ahí donde tiene sentido la política. Pero sucumbir al síndrome de Macbeth en este caso es también equívoco por una segunda razón, que es donde está teniendo lugar algunos de los argumentos fundamentales que están llevando a la proliferación, y es la idea de que el armamento nuclear solo puede ser eso, armamento nuclear, o dicho de otra manera, de que la capacidad nuclear solo sirve para suministrar armamento nuclear. Justamente lo que el propio Tratado de No Proliferación reconoce es que hay usos civiles que son legítimos de la capacidad nuclear, y es en esa capacidad, en ese umbral que va desde el uso civil al uso militar, donde se juega la principal partida que estamos desarrollando en estos momentos. Por tanto, ya digo, creo que a efectos de tener ese marco de referencia común para interpretar las amenazas y, por tanto, ponernos de acuerdo en qué amenazas estamos enfrentando, habría que desterrar este equívoco, este síndrome de Macbeth en todas sus dimensiones. Pero, aparte del equívoco, hay que hacer frente a otra cuestión, y es que en el marco de referencia, en el marco de interpretación de las amenazas, nos encontramos también con opciones previas, con opciones políticas previas frente a la realidad que debemos interpretar. Y entre esas opciones políticas previas, yo creo que la fundamental, la principal opción que está dificultando el hecho de que tengamos un análisis compartido de las amenazas, es saber si en el análisis, si en la interpretación, estamos optando o estamos haciendo esa interpretación desde una idea de la superioridad como respuesta a la proliferación, o, por el contrario, optamos por una idea del equilibrio como respuesta a la proliferación. Yo creo que en los últimos años ha habido suficientes vaivenes en torno a cuál era la posición desde la que se interpretaba la realidad. Podemos decir, sin ánimo de generalizar, que en el periodo último de Bush la idea de superioridad era una idea querida. Era una idea acariciada por la diplomacia norteamericana, en el sentido de que la manera de hacer frente a la proliferación era garantizar, sobre todo, la superioridad de quienes ya estaban en el arma, o, en este caso, de Estados Unidos. Plantear el análisis de la realidad y, por consiguiente, de las amenazas desde un presupuesto de superioridad, lo que lleva es a una reflexión que trata de buscar argumentos para justificar un monopolio exclusivo o algo ampliado. La superioridad necesariamente lleva a pensar cómo legitimar, cómo hacer comprensible el hecho de que unos países tengan el arma nuclear y otros, sin embargo, no lo tengan. Si miramos a lo que ha ocurrido en los últimos tiempos, y creo que el profesor Korb ha desarrollado una parte sustancial de este razonamiento, lo que vemos es justamente que los planteamientos se han hecho sobre la base de ver qué países eran merecedores del arma y qué países, por el contrario, no la merecían porque suponían una amenaza adicional para la cuestión nuclear, para el dossier nuclear mundial. Y esa aproximación, en gran medida, no solo no ha impedido la proliferación, sino que podría estar en el origen de la última oleada de la proliferación. Justamente negar a países como Irán, lo cual no quiere decir que miremos ciegamente lo que ocurre en Irán, pero negarles los derechos que se derivan del Tratado de No Proliferación sobre la base de que es un país que no merece la capacidad nuclear, lejos de impedir la proliferación nuclear, lo que hace es seguramente estimular la proliferación nuclear. Insisto que este razonamiento no hay que enmarcarlo en la idea de que no ocurre nada con Irán, podemos aceptar cualquier desarrollo de ese programa de Irán mientras esté dentro del Tratado de No Proliferación, porque, como se señalaba por parte de Bruno, el récord histórico de Irán lo que nos pone es ante la evidencia de dificultades en el control de sus arsenales, de sus programas, falta de transparencia, por tanto, por una falta de cumplimiento de las obligaciones internacionales. Pero insisto que, subrayada esta cuestión, lo importante es tener presente que la idea de plantear la superioridad como argumento, como instrumento frente a la proliferación, es algo que quizá tendríamos que asumir, que no ha impedido la proliferación, sino que la ha estimulado. Al mismo tiempo, esta idea de superioridad que lleva a una reflexión sobre el monopolio no se extiende únicamente a los actores estatales, se extiende además a los actores no estatales, a los grupos terroristas. Yo creo que aquí el acuerdo es general, que si el armamento nuclear va a subsistir durante algún tiempo, más o menos largo, pese a que todo el mundo está en la idea de que sería mucho mejor un mundo sin armas nucleares que sin ellas, lo que es claro es que mientras eso sea así, preferible sin duda que no caiga en manos de organizaciones o de actores no estatales. Pero lo que es importante subrayar es que si se plantea la no proliferación, en este caso podríamos hablar mejor de dispersión nuclear, desde el presupuesto de la superioridad, muchas veces vamos a llegar a una conclusión errónea sobre los objetivos y los instrumentos que debemos aplicar para evitar esta proliferación en actores no estatales, esta dispersión nuclear. Y es creer que se tratan los mismos, se debía tratar con los mismos instrumentos la proliferación estatal que la dispersión en estas organizaciones. Y hay que hacer una separación nítida entre los instrumentos para hacerles frente. Mientras que la proliferación es una cuestión política, diplomática y estratégica en el sentido clásico, hacer frente a la dispersión nuclear de organizaciones y de actores no estatales lo que exige es sistemas de inteligencia, sistemas, para entendernos, de policía. Y conviene no mezclar ambas cuestiones, porque si no podemos llegar a planteamientos quizá inviables y seguramente altamente irritantes para determinados sectores de la comunidad internacional que encontrarán en ellos un estímulo para la proliferación. Quiero decir, cuando se plantean situaciones como impedir el desarrollo del programa nuclear iraní sobre la base de la fuerza, sobre la base de una medida, para entendernos, de la suma de inteligencia y policía, por entendernos, lo que vamos a ver es que se le concede a Irán la legitimidad que necesita o que busca para desarrollar ese programa en términos de defensa. Por tanto, ya digo, dentro de las opciones que conducen a un marco de referencia necesario para interpretar la realidad y, por tanto, las amenazas que tenemos, esta idea de la superioridad es una idea, es una opción, pero existe una idea alternativa que también está operando en estos tiempos y que quizá no operó tanto hace una década, y es la idea del equilibrio. Si se plantea la idea del equilibrio como instrumento para hacer frente a la proliferación, lo que observamos es que, a diferencia de la superioridad, que lo que llevaba era una reflexión sobre el monopolio, la idea del equilibrio lo que nos lleva es a varias reflexiones simultáneas. La primera es una reflexión sobre los interlocutores, una reflexión sobre la circunstancia en la que nos encontramos, en la cual hay países que disponen del arma nuclear sin ser firmantes del Tratado de No Proliferación, hay países que han firmado el Tratado de No Proliferación y son poseedores del arma, y hay países que están, por el momento y hasta donde se sabe, dentro del Tratado de No Proliferación, pero que podrían llegar a superar el umbral y, por tanto, a estar en condiciones de crear el arma. La cuestión, cuando se ve el análisis de la realidad y el análisis de las amenazas, por tanto, desde el principio, desde el presupuesto del equilibrio, la cuestión es saber si tenemos que cerrar la nómina de interlocutores en la ya existente o, por el contrario, lo que hay que hacer es ampliar la nómina de los interlocutores. Es una opción política nada sencilla, porque efectivamente si lo planteamos mirando a Irán, es una opción que conlleva, cuando menos, unas garantías de control y de transparencia que hasta ahora no se han dado, pero eso no exime a la comunidad internacional, no exime a las principales potencias el hecho de tomar una decisión sobre si los interlocutores deben ser una nómina cerrada o, por el contrario, debe repartirse de nuevo la baraja con todas las garantías suficientes. Lleva además a una segunda reflexión la idea del equilibrio, la interpretar la realidad desde el presupuesto del equilibrio, que es la reflexión sobre el lenguaje. Al final, la disposición del arma nuclear es una disposición y una tenencia que lo que ha servido ha sido para relacionarse entre potencias enemigas, por entendernos, de una determinada manera. Desplegar misiles, y lo hemos visto en esta misma mesa, desplegar misiles fuera del territorio de Estados Unidos conlleva una interpretación por parte de la Unión Soviética en su día, de Rusia en estos momentos. Negociar un descenso de los arsenales estratégicos supone para los diversos actores consecuencias diversas. Nos contaba Orlov cómo no es posible para Rusia en este momento seguir planteándose un horizonte indefinido de negociación a la baja con Estados Unidos si no se tiene en cuenta el arsenal chino. Es decir, que lo que observamos es que hay que ponerse de acuerdo en el lenguaje. El arma nuclear, por fortuna para todos, no ha sido utilizada, ha sido, sin embargo, instrumento, ha sido una especie de sucesión de frases y de palabras en un lenguaje que tras la Guerra Fría ha quedado en entredicho. Y yo sumaría estas dos reflexiones sobre el presupuesto del equilibrio como elemento para analizar la realidad que está llevando a la proliferación, una tercera idea, que es la idea de comprometerse con el salto, con la imposibilidad del salto, por ser más exactos, entre lo convencional y lo nuclear. La tentación, yo creo que en determinados discursos, de considerar ese umbral absolutamente cosa del pasado, la posibilidad de, teniendo en cuenta que el arma nuclear puede graduarse en estos momentos en cuanto a su fuerza, pues la tentación de ir a bombas nucleares de baja potencia para sortear la cuestión del umbral entre lo convencional y lo nuclear puede ser un principio extraordinariamente peligroso y, por tanto, conviene subrayar que dentro de esa reflexión sobre el equilibrio estaría bien reforzar la idea del umbral insalvable entre lo convencional y lo nuclear. Este es más o menos, a mi juicio, el panorama de los equívocos, como decía, y de las opciones para interpretar la realidad a la que nos enfrentamos e intentar hacer frente a la proliferación. Equívocos, como les señalaba, del síndrome de Macbeth y presupuestos por los que hay que optar, que es saber si se negocia desde la idea de la superioridad o se negocia desde la idea del equilibrio. Dependiendo de qué posición tomemos, tiene sentido el título de este seminario o no lo tiene. Si nosotros nos colocamos en la posición, en la opción de la superioridad, es claro que no es fácil entrever cuándo se producirá un horizonte desnuclearizado. Si nos instalamos en el plano del equilibrio, de la búsqueda del equilibrio, es donde tiene sentido el suponer y el reivindicar que haya un horizonte sin armas nucleares. Desde la base del equilibrio, de un equilibrio general, con interlocutores reconocidos, con la baraja enteramente repartida, es donde únicamente, al menos en hipótesis, se puede avanzar en esa idea de un mundo desnuclearizado. Con todo este instrumental, yo creo que acabaría haciendo mención a dos situaciones concretas que se están produciendo y que nos muestran, a mi juicio, el cómo es muy importante tener presente este marco de referencia para no confundir el análisis y, por tanto, no llegar a una evaluación diferente de las amenazas e incluso a percibir amenazas diferentes. Ha salido la cuestión de Pakistán. Pakistán no es un caso de proliferación. Pakistán es un caso de país nuclearizado que puede caer en las malas manos. Pero no es exactamente un caso de proliferación. Un caso de proliferación, por el contrario, es Irán. Y en Irán el problema al que nos enfrentamos es que la legalidad internacional es una legalidad que puede ser usada en contra del equilibrio, en contra del lenguaje compartido. Irán alega constantemente que está dentro del Tratado de No Proliferación en el recorrido que lleva en su programa de enriquecimiento de uranio. Si alguna observación hay que hacer, es la observación de que en el pasado no ha respetado los controles, no ha respetado las inspecciones y, por tanto, se exigen garantías suplementarias. Yo no estaría tan seguro del resto de observaciones que hacía Bruno, en el sentido de que no hay que fiarse de Irán no solo porque en el pasado no haya respetado las inspecciones y no haya tenido una actitud suficientemente transparente, sino que, decía Bruno, además hay que tener en cuenta que tiene una gran ambición regional, que además pues su régimen es un régimen de una naturaleza dictatorial y otro componente más que señalaba Bruno. Yo creo que en el primer caso, en el caso de subrayar que Irán es un país que no ha respetado la legalidad internacional para desarrollar su programa, es una observación que se enmarca claramente en el presupuesto, en la opción de que lo que se busca es el equilibrio. El gran reproche a Irán sería, en este caso, que no ha cumplido con la legalidad internacional. Por el contrario, el resto de las observaciones que hacía Bruno eran observaciones que, a mi juicio, son pertinentes, no es ni mucho menos un juicio sobre la pertinencia o impertinencia de las observaciones, sino que pertenecen al otro presupuesto, al presupuesto de la superioridad, al presupuesto de que un país con ambiciones regionales o un país con un régimen dictatorial no debe tener acceso al arma nuclear. Es importante, entonces, como señalaba, que nos fijemos en cuáles son los presupuestos desde los que analizamos la realidad y, de algún modo, para concluir, lo que sugeriría es justamente tratar de esforzarnos, si es posible, en esta mesa, en llegar no a una respuesta compartida al riesgo de la proliferación, sino a un análisis compartido de los riesgos que suponen para todos nosotros la proliferación.
Muchas gracias. Una hora y 35 minutos es lo que ha durado. En las últimas intervenciones he vuelto a pensar en alguna experiencia que fue a finales de los 70. Yo estaba de estudiante en el máster de Relaciones Internacionales en Columbia y tenía un profesor que era a la vez el director de la revista Foreign Affairs, Edward Morse, y que coordinaba, aunque quien presidía el grupo era Cyrus Vance, en el Council on Foreign Relations, un proyecto que se llamó el proyecto de los años 80. Y uno de los debates era la proliferación nuclear, el futuro de las armas nucleares. Otro era la energía, otro era el futuro de China. Y recuerdo que participábamos, los que estamos haciendo el máster, en algunos de los foros de los debates, y guardo los libros de cada uno de aquellos temas, lo que se pensaba, ¿no? Y recuerdo que cuando, después de uno de esos debates, nos hace un resumen el que luego fue decano, Donald Puchala se llamaba, que daba Management of International Affairs, empezaba así la conferencia: ¿cómo sería el mundo con 30, 40, 50 países nuclearizados, ¿no? Y es que en realidad la visión a la que se llegó en aquellos análisis daban, entre los distintos escenarios finales, uno como bastante probable, que situaba al mundo de hoy, año 2000, me parece que era, aunque el título genérico era los años 80, y estamos hablando de la segunda mitad de los 70, un mínimo de 20 a 30 potencias nucleares, ¿no? Bueno, pensando hoy lo que ha ocurrido, deberíamos sentirnos todos optimistas. Ahora, si pensamos en lo que pudo haber sido antes del lanzamiento de la primera bomba nuclear, aquellas propuestas del Plan Baruch de multilateralizar de verdad, de poner los medios nucleares a disposición de una comisión internacional, algo que me sugería o ha sugerido los últimos discursos de Javier Solana, después de tanto pelearse con los iraníes, cuando finalmente proponía, y muchos compartían esa idea, de realmente organizar el tema del material fisible y hacer facilitar el combustible a los países que realmente lo necesitan sin facilitarles el trabajo, de modo que puedan luego desviar ese material para proyectos militares, ¿no? Y ahí nos lleva a sentirnos muy pesimistas. Bueno, no me alargo más. Tenéis la palabra. Quien quiera hacer una pregunta, les agradecería que se presenten para que luego se pueda recoger en el libro que se publique. Y si pueden ser las preguntas concretas y dirigidas a la persona en concreto que quieran hacérsela, mejor. Muchas gracias.
Soy Martín Ortega, de la Universidad Complutense de Madrid. Quiero felicitar a los oradores, a los intervinientes, porque me ha parecido una mesa realmente variada, con puntos de vista complementarios y que ha tratado los asuntos muy directamente y de manera muy interesante. Yo tengo tres preguntas, la primera para Lawrence Korb. Y me gustaría que desarrollara un poco más por qué Estados Unidos está opuesto de una manera tan radical al tratado CTBT, al tratado de prohibición de las pruebas nucleares. Quizás muchos no sepan que durante décadas se realizaron en el mundo entre 50 y 70 ensayos nucleares, subterráneos, en el mar o en la atmósfera. Esta práctica de las pruebas nucleares fue realmente desastrosa para el medio ambiente, como se ha demostrado, e incluso se probaba con cobayas humanos, es decir, se probaba con miembros de las Fuerzas Armadas que se sometían a diversos grados de cercanía a las explosiones. Entonces, en la actualidad, esta frecuencia ha bajado mucho. Si vemos una curva de frecuencia, realmente ya no hay pruebas nucleares. Las últimas fueron de Pakistán, India y probablemente de Corea del Norte más recientemente, pero llevamos ya prácticamente 20 años sin pruebas nucleares. Entonces, lo que a mí me sorprende es que Estados Unidos, teniendo la ventaja tecnológica tan grande que tiene, de manera que puede simular todo tipo de pruebas nucleares con ordenadores y puede estudiar muy bien el desarrollo de nuevas armas nucleares, ¿por qué se sigue negando a que se prohíban las pruebas nucleares en el mundo cuando esto beneficia sobre todo a los que están entrando en el club nuclear, que además tienen un efecto político con esas pruebas nucleares? La segunda pregunta es para Bruno Tertre. Él me ha dicho antes que quería mantenernos despiertos a la hora de la siesta, y yo creo que nos ha mantenido despiertos con sus malas noticias, Él ha hablado de buenas noticias y malas noticias. Las buenas, las malas noticias eran muy impresionantes. Lo que él ha dicho sobre Irán es preocupante. Pero la pregunta mía para él no va sobre Irán, sino sobre Pakistán, porque en cambio lo he encontrado muy relajado sobre Pakistán. Si he entendido bien, Bruno ha dicho que no debemos preocuparnos sobre Pakistán. Y yo le querría preguntar, ¿es que acaso el control del ejército de Pakistán o de las múltiples facciones del ejército y de las inteligencias, en plural, en Pakistán, es suficiente? Y si acaso debemos estar tranquilos realmente sobre los posibles desvíos de las armas nucleares pakistaníes, porque la historia demuestra que si ha habido proliferación y desvíos de armas nucleares ha sido a través de redes lideradas desde Pakistán, y desde luego es el arma más cercana por el momento al mundo islamista, ¿no? Entonces yo quisiera que él desarrollara un poquito, que elaborara esa idea de que Pakistán no constituye una amenaza. Y mi tercera pregunta es para José María Ridao. Realmente me ha parecido muy sugerente esa división que ha hecho él entre debatir la proliferación nuclear desde la superioridad o desde el equilibrio, ¿no? Y efectivamente yo creo que es una buena forma de pensar sobre el futuro de la proliferación nuclear. Y a mí me gustaría preguntarle más concretamente sobre el caso de Irán a este respecto. Irán, y aquí conecto con lo que ha dicho Bruno Tertré, está quizás más allá del umbral, o está ya en el umbral, pero con una velocidad tal que no se puede detener. Y entonces, en el debate estratégico internacional hay varias teorías. Hay algunos que apuntan que debemos evitar a toda costa que Irán adquiera el arma nuclear. Y hay otros que han dicho que sería la idea de superioridad. Y hay otros que han dicho que tenemos que acostumbrarnos a vivir con un Irán nuclear. Por ejemplo, en Francia, Pascal Boniface, que participó el año pasado en estas jornadas, el director del IRIS en París, él ha escrito explícitamente que tenemos que pensar en un mundo con un Irán nuclear y que tenemos que acostumbrarnos a esta situación. Me gustaría preguntar a José María, conocedor como él es de la región de Oriente Medio, ¿cómo ve él un mundo con un Irán nuclear? O sea, ¿él piensa que eso plantearía problemas, que iríamos hacia una proliferación de otros actores de la región, como ha dicho el Bruno, o podemos vivir con un Irán nuclear? Porque algunos mantienen que el hecho de que haya más potencias nucleares lleva al equilibrio. Es decir, que de alguna manera equilibra la situación y hace más difícil la guerra nuclear. Entonces, ¿cómo ve él esa situación en un Oriente Medio con un Irán nuclear? Gracias.
When it comes to treaties, you've got to understand two things. One is the American political system, and the other is the sort of bitterness that exists between the two political parties right now. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, we haven't ratified, but we keep to the terms. We have still not ratified the Law of the Sea Convention, which even the U.S. Navy has been arguing for years. Now you say, why? Well, you need to get two-thirds of the senators. Given the fact that there is this sort of bitterness now, and a lot has to do with the way in which we've gerrymandered our district. In other words, what has happened now, the Republican Party is pretty much in the South and the West. There are no Republican congressmen from New England, none. So the Democrats are there, they're in the Midwest. The only way to lose an election is in the primary. How do you lose an election in the primary if you cooperate with the other party? Somebody from the left or from the right will challenge you. Bob Bennett, a conservative senator from Utah, basically 97% of the time he voted with the Republicans. 3% he cooperated with Obama. He lost the primary. Okay? So you also have a feeling on the part of some people that the international organizations and these treaties, really what it is an attempt by the rest of the world to constrain the United States. And that sells in some of these elections. And periodically you have people say, let's get rid of the UN, you know, let's turn the building, you know, in New York into a hotel or whatever it might be. You also, I'll give you an example. When President Bush signed the agreement with Iraq to say we would get out in 3 years, and also a status of forces agreement about our forces there in terms of whether you can prosecute them or anything, he did not want to send that to the Senate to get it ratified. It's an agreement. It's not a treaty, even though our status of forces agreement with other countries are treaties, and back in the old days when you had this bipartisanship, you could get it. So he did not even want to do it. And then the final thing is, well, you need 2/3 to ratify a treaty. You need 60 to get anything done domestically because of the filibuster. And presidents are saying, do I spend my political capital on health care, which I want, or do I put it on the CTBT, which most Americans don't care about, and we're staying with it anyway.
Thank you. Bruno.
Before I come to Pakistan, let me say a word about what you said, Felipe, about multinational fuel cycle facilities. It's a great idea. It has always been a great idea, and it will continue to be a great idea. The problem is that nobody is interested in this great idea. I mean, those who are interested are not the kind of countries that may pose a proliferation risk. Egypt, Brazil, you know, Japan, South Africa, Indonesia, they are just not interested. By the way, Iran is not interested either. So it's a great cost-effective device for countries which have an economic approach of nuclear fuel issues. But it's not a useful non-proliferation measure. I mean, despite all the goodwill of, you know, the Russians, of the EU, and the IAEA, and all those who have suggested setting up such facilities. Same thing about fuel assurances. Why am I so relaxed about Pakistan? I mean, relaxed, it may be excessive, but fairly confident. First of all, you mentioned factions, but I don't think that there are factions in the army. My understanding of the functioning, the internal functioning of the Pakistani army, is that it's not made of factions. There are Islamists, there are jihadis even in the army, small percentage, not bigger than the, you know, probably smaller percentage than in the population in general. They are not organized, and most Pakistani officers are much more faithful to the army than to any other institution. And the way the selection of the military elites functions is that you cannot go very high up in the hierarchy if you are a bearded one, as they call them. So, yes, I'm fairly confident. About the controls, let me just some additional details. Four things happened after the 1998 tests. The first thing is that the Pakistani army decided to become an operational nuclear power. So they began setting up institutions, procedures, and control mechanisms that did not exist before 1998. The second thing that happened is that the Musharraf coup in October 1999, for the first time since almost the inception of the program, put nuclear weapons entirely into the hands of the army, 100%. This did not exist before. The third thing that happened was September 11 and the famous Armitage injunction, so to say. Well, okay, I was trying to be diplomatic. You're with us or against us, and if you're against us, you'll be back to the Stone Age momentarily. And I think that had an effect, especially since that coincided with the discovery of the campfire, the meeting in Kandahar around a campfire between Bin Laden, al-Zawahiri, and two former officials of the Pakistani nuclear program. So, the post September 11 context made it even more imperative for the Pakistanis to get serious about the control of their program. And finally, there was in late 2003 the discovery of the full extent of the exploits made by the network. And even though Musharraf himself probably knew at least partly of what had been done by the network, I suspect that even Musharraf did not know everything about what had happened. So I think for these four reasons, the Pakistanis got very serious. There was also some technical assistance by some foreign countries, even though the Pakistanis do not want foreign countries inside their programs. I mean, at least some countries tried to be helpful. So, for all these reasons, I don't think it's, frankly, I don't think it's a problem today. I think there are three problems related with a nuclear Pakistan. One, I think you cannot exclude that one day there is a severe crisis between the U.S. and Pakistan at the moment where some say it's already happening, but that's not what I call a severe crisis. I mean, it has always been in crisis, so to say. But maybe one day you'll have a severe disjunction between U.S. objectives in the region and Pakistani objectives in the region. The second scenario is if Saudi Arabia says, we've founded your program for a long time, now we need your help, what do you do? And this is a scenario that may already be happening, actually. But you have to see this issue, of course, as a triangular relationship between Riyadh, Islamabad, and Washington, but that has the potential for posing problems to the United States and, I would say, to Europe as well, at least indirectly. The third problem is a long-term one. I'm confident with the ability of the Pakistani army to control the program today. I'm not confident in the integrity of the Pakistani state and institutions in 20 years from now. Now, considering that Pakistan is developing both its civilian and military fissile material production facilities, considering that its nuclear program is on the rise, I mean that there are legitimate questions, I think, about what happened to these facilities, weapons, and materials, not now, but say in 10 or 20 years from now.
José María.
Yo creo, Martín, que la opción que describías perfectamente entre evitar que Irán tenga el programa, un desarrollo de su programa nuclear a toda costa, o acostumbrarse a un Irán nuclear, es una alternativa que es en gran medida ficticia. Y es ficticia en múltiples sentidos. Es ficticia, en primer lugar, porque lamentablemente no está en manos de nadie el impedir el programa nuclear iraní en este momento. La gran alternativa es cómo lo va a tener, fuera de cualquier negociación o dentro de un marco de negociación. Esa es la realidad, si no nos hacemos trampa con el solitario. Y lo que hay que preguntarse es por qué hemos llegado a una situación donde efectivamente parar el programa nuclear iraní o convivir con él no es una alternativa real, no es una alternativa que se nos vaya a plantear. Y la respuesta es justamente una de las cuestiones que han suscitado este seminario. Y es que en los últimos años hemos asistido a un deterioro gravísimo de la disuasión convencional. Y hemos asistido a ese deterioro gravísimo de la disuasión convencional en dos frentes cruciales para abordar el dossier iraní. Por un lado, en la guerra de Irak, en la última guerra de Irak,
que es una guerra en la que se produce una situación en la que ni victoria ni derrota para el principal ejército del mundo, con una extensión, bueno, que fue, podemos decir, previa a esta extensión, que es Afganistán, donde nos encontramos en la misma situación, y por tanto, ni por razones económicas, ni por razones estratégicas, ni por múltiples razones, una amenaza convencional es en este momento creíble para Irán desde esta perspectiva, desde la perspectiva norteamericana. Pero es que hay otro escenario donde ha ocurrido exactamente lo mismo en el ámbito de la disuasión convencional y a partir de una fecha muy concreta, que es el año 2000, que es Israel. O sea, no solo la gran potencia mundial, sino la gran potencia regional ha dilapidado, por decirlo de algún modo, su disuasión convencional. ¿Cómo la ha dilapidado Israel? Con la retirada de una franja de seguridad de 100 kilómetros en Líbano que nunca debió ocupar o nunca debió gestionar de esa manera. Por tanto, se retira, por consiguiente, concede una victoria política a Hezbollah. Ese error, el mismo error de la franja de seguridad en el sur del Líbano, se comete por parte del ejército israelí, de los estrategas israelíes, en 2006 con el ataque a Líbano. Una vez más, ni gana la guerra ni se puede decir que la pierda, y por tanto, para el ejército más poderoso de la región, eso significa una derrota política fundamental que, una vez más, refuerza la posición de Hezbollah. Y por si esto no fuera bastante, en 2006 nos encontramos con la operación Plomo Fundido en 2009, en la que Israel ataca sobre las mismas bases una pequeña porción de territorio como es Gaza, y la situación final es que el ejército israelí tampoco consigue los objetivos militares declarados, que eran por lo demás objetivos muy difíciles, por no decir imposibles de cumplir, como era erradicar a Hamas. Y ahora nos encontramos, después de la cuestión del buque Mavi Marmara, en una vuelta de tuerca sobre esa pérdida de peso, pérdida de credibilidad de la disuasión convencional. Y es que Israel se coloca en una situación en la cual mantener el bloqueo sobre Gaza, digamos, le hace perder el alma. Es un bloqueo que roza, en fin, la barbarie, y si levanta el bloqueo, le concede una victoria absoluta a Hamas. Quizá la victoria más importante que haya obtenido un grupo palestino desde la ocupación. Es decir, Gaza se convertiría en algo así como el territorio liberado de Hamas, no porque Hamas tenga una fuerza militar ilimitada, sino porque Hamas ha jugado de una manera muy llamativa y ha convertido la inmoralidad del sacrificio de una población en un instrumento político de primer orden, contando con que Israel no haría diferencia entre la población civil y los milicianos de Hamas. Es decir, contando con la otra parte, Hamas capitaliza algo que un gobierno debe hacer, que es, ante la superioridad aplastante de un enemigo, reconocer que su primer deber es proteger a su población. Jamás abandona eso y, por tanto, digamos, consigue una victoria. Todo esto hace que la alternativa en estos momentos no sea si Irán va a tener el arma nuclear o se puede parar, o tenemos que acostumbrarnos a vivir. La alternativa es que Irán está en condiciones de no, digamos, detener su programa nuclear sobre la base de ninguna amenaza. Ni la amenaza de las sanciones, ni la amenaza convencional, porque no opera. A todo esto hay que sumar, y con esto acabo, que el error del buque, del ataque, a partir del asesinato de 9 personas, el buque Mavi Marmara por parte de Israel, lo que ha generado es una situación en el mismo momento en el que se aprueban las sanciones, en la cual Irán, en lugar de quedar aislado, encuentra comprensión en países como Turquía, previamente en países como Brasil, en todo un entorno regional que le permite, por lo menos desde el punto de vista político, minimizar el impacto de las sanciones.
Gracias. Les pediría, porque nos ha llevado 35 minutos la primera serie o tanda de preguntas, evidentemente no puede ser si queremos que intervengan varios. Yo les agradecería a quien pregunta, y sobre todo a los que responden, pero también a los que preguntan, que sean breves y concisos. No es el programa 59 segundos, pero, hombre, con un poquito de flexibilidad para que puedan intervenir varios. Gracias. Venga. Enrique.
Vale. A José María, en relación con esa posibilidad que él no descarta de que un país en un momento decida o crea tener la necesidad de traspasar ese umbral entre las armas convencionales y las armas nucleares y pueda hacer detonar una bomba nuclear de escasa potencia en un momento determinado, ¿qué consideraría él de escasa potencia en ese caso? ¿Cuántas veces, digamos, la bomba de Hiroshima podría llegar a tener un ingenio de ese tipo? ¿Y cuáles serían entre sus consecuencias? ¿No desencadenaría a partir de ahí, pues eso, el se conseguiría evitar el holocausto nuclear? Y en general, al que quisiera contestar, tras el desorden que siguió a la descomposición de la Unión Soviética y con las tentaciones económicas a los científicos nucleares más o menos. Tras las tentaciones, digo, ¿cómo es posible que en todo este tiempo? Bien, pila nueva, new battery. La amenaza de, no digo ya de una explosión de convencional incontrolada, sino a lo mejor de una de esas bombas sucias puestas en marcha por grupúsculos o entidades, una bomba del tipo de la que aparecía, por ejemplo, en la ficción de El Cuarto Protocolo. ¿Cómo es posible que se haya podido evitar? A veces en España decimos no producen más desgracias porque Dios no quiere y no se sabe si el control sería suficiente para evitar acontecimientos de este tipo y en qué medida pues lo consideran posible en cualquier caso.
Respuestas breves, por favor.
Sí, respecto de la posibilidad de que hubiera un uso de una bomba, yo creo que hay que ponerlo en el contexto. El contexto es que todo avance en el programa nuclear iraní es una pérdida de garantía existencial para Israel en la interpretación de sus estrategas. Por consiguiente, lo que vemos es que mientras Irán continúe con el programa nuclear, la estrategia israelí o los estrategas israelíes consideran que la seguridad última, o sea, la garantía existencial israelí se está mermando. Por tanto, hay un riesgo de que haya la tentación de detener el programa nuclear iraní por vías distintas de las diplomáticas. Si la opción fuera convencional, la opción convencional exigiría un esfuerzo de inteligencia para saber dónde están los hilos, los aceleradores de partículas, en fin, todo la parafernalia del programa nuclear iraní, por un conocimiento exacto y riguroso y total, y por otro lado se exigiría que la ejecución de ese ataque fuera perfecta, no hubiera un solo error, porque en el supuesto que hubiera un error se daría toda la legitimidad a Irán para seguir adelante con el programa. Por consiguiente, ahí es donde surge no el pronóstico, sino la hipótesis de que restablecer la disuasión exija superar el escalón convencional y entrar en el escalón nuclear. Para eso, lo importante no es la cantidad, sino que es los efectos. Si alguien estuviera pensando en dar ese salto, lo lógico, insisto, es una hipótesis, no es un pronóstico, lo lógico es que lo planteara con unos efectos humanos mínimos. Sencillamente, lo importante sería el mensaje. Para nosotros, el escalón convencional que lleva al nuclear ya no opera.
Anyone in the table?
Yeah. Can I interject something? I think our colleague is confusing the causes and the effects. And frankly, I don't think you have a clear perspective of the Israeli costs and benefits calculation. It's only if Israel or the United States, for that matter, believe that it can accurately pinpoint the key nodes of the program that it would then
be able to consider military action. No military action is perfect. Most of the time, it's actually pretty horrendous and very imperfect. But you don't need a military action to be perfect. You do a cost and benefits analysis. How much of the program can I destroy? By how many years could I possibly delay the program? This is the benefit side. Then how much does this cost me in terms of possible retaliation, etc.? This is the cost analysis, the cost and benefits analysis that you do. I don't think it's an appropriate reflection of the current calculation of the Israeli leadership that was described earlier on. Now, do I think that an Israeli action is probable? No. I've always said that I've always thought that it's very improbable. Do I think that it has zero chance of happening in the next 2 years? No, absolutely not. I think it has some chance of happening, but I think it will happen only if the Israelis are confident that they know enough about the program that they could do some very significant damage to the program. And you certainly do not need nuclear weapons for that.
Thank you very much. Breve.
No acabo de entender la confusión que se produce en mi exposición entre causas y efectos, que decía Bruno, nuestro colega. Lo que sí puedo decir es que la información de la que se dispone es que el gobierno israelí, concretamente el primer ministro israelí, transmite a destacados representantes de la prensa europea que su conocimiento de los silos y de los lugares donde se encuentra el programa nuclear iraní es absoluto y que, por tanto, no descartan en absoluto un ataque contra estos silos. Podemos considerar que esto es pro forma. La obligación es tener una respuesta al caso peor. Podemos, como digo, considerar que esto es pro forma, of course, pero podemos considerar también que esta es la peor de las hipótesis y que, por tanto, tener una estrategia que evite las consecuencias indeseables que tendría ese ataque nos obligue a tener una respuesta a que esa, en fin, respuesta pro forma, esa posición pro forma, pues fuera real.
Gracias. ¿Alguna otra pregunta? Miguel Ángel.
Bueno, hemos empezado hablando del agotamiento de la... o hemos terminado hablando del agotamiento de la disuasión convencional y hemos terminado hablando de Oriente Medio y en particular de la angustia existencial de Israel y de cómo pretende curarse de esa angustia desde la superioridad absoluta. Pero a mí me parece que esa pretensión, o sea, que esa pretensión de superioridad a partir de un momento, o ese hecho de su superioridad a partir de un momento, deja de proporcionar garantía y pasa a convertirse, a estimular mayores problemas, a crearle mayores problemas. De forma que, mirando hacia adelante, hacia el horizonte, yo no creo que la garantía existencial de Israel pueda seguir siendo su superioridad absoluta, sino que tendrá que empezar a ser depositada en un sistema de equilibrio. Eso es lo que yo creo. Entonces, si se agota con los casos que ha puesto José María sobre la mesa, Afganistán, Irak, Líbano, etcétera, Gaza, si hay un agotamiento de la disuasión convencional, ¿cuál es el paso siguiente? Si la disuasión convencional no funciona, entonces tenemos un sistema de... en fin, de última garantía, que es el arma nuclear. Pero si el arma nuclear la tienen otros, también en ese mismo área, en esa misma escala, en esa misma... Entonces, volvemos al empate. Nadie va a hacer uso primero porque no quiere la respuesta del otro. Es decir, estaremos a una escala regional repitiendo el equilibrio de la mutua destrucción asegurada. De manera que a mí me parece que estamos en un momento en que deberíamos empezar a pensar en pasar de fiarlo todo a la superioridad absoluta en el campo convencional y luego en el campo nuclear, que nadie ha llegado a una fórmula en que la garantía, la llamada garantía existencial, sea más fuerte, pero si se quiere, pero sea más equilibrada, y no pensar que siempre la superioridad cada vez mayor, cada vez más extrema, va a proporcionar mayor seguridad, porque eso a mí me parece que tiene un momento en que deja de funcionar, como el vino, las buenas cosechas de vino mejoran y luego a partir de un año se pican y hay que tirarlas, no se pueden beber. El vino no mejora indefinidamente, la garantía esta de la superioridad tampoco.
¿Quieres que responda alguien o no hace falta?
Quien quiera, si alguien quiere, y si no, pues ahí se queda. Sí, no sé.
I think you're getting back to what Dr. Kissinger said when we signed our first strategic, it was then called SALT agreement with the Soviet Union, Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, and we allowed the Soviets to have numerically more launchers than we had. And there were people in the Senate said, well, we can't have that. In fact, you had the Jackson Amendment that said we could never sign a treaty with the Soviets again in which they had any advantage. And Kissinger, you know, said, what in the blank is strategic superiority, and what do you do with it? And I think that's the point that you're getting to here in terms of nuclear superiority. As I mentioned in my talk, I'm a firm believer that deterrence, extended deterrence, can work as well in the 21st century as it did in the 20th. We had the Vance Doctrine under President Carter, which extended nuclear guarantees to non-nuclear states. We extended it to South Korea and Japan when China developed a nuclear weapon. And what I would like to see is President Obama at some point talk about extended deterrence for the countries. Secretary Clinton has more or less hinted at it, but I think we have to be very, very clear. And then, of course, if you have, quote, unquote, two nuclear powers there, the question goes back, well, what do you do with them? And I would also argue that when a country develops nuclear weapons, they are actually less safe than they were before. I don't know what people are going to do, but the chances of somebody taking action against you actually could increase, or the devastation. So I think you have to put all those things into context, and I don't think we need to overreact. That's the point I was trying to make, because I remember people say, the Bush administration, we will not let North Korea get nuclear weapons. Well, they got them. What'd you do with them? The North Koreans just sank a South Korean ship. What did you do? You can't solve all international problems. You have to live with them. You have to learn to manage them. And so I think we can manage this. We've managed worse. And I think we have to be careful about the rhetoric, that it doesn't force us to do things that we don't like.
Sí, es decir, que estoy de acuerdo con lo que decía Miguel Ángel. Lo único es que el tránsito de una solución de superioridad a una solución de equilibrio no es automático, en el sentido de que no se pueden mantener los instrumentos de la solución de superioridad en la solución de equilibrio. ¿En qué sentido digo esto? En el sentido de que si se pasa por parte de Israel, porque otros muchos países, yo creo que la propia política de Obama van en ese cambio de la superioridad al equilibrio en Oriente Próximo. Pero si se cambia por parte de Israel, lo que hay que aceptar entonces es que Irán es un interlocutor. Ese es el punto difícil. Pero nos encontramos con que hasta ahora los instrumentos de la superioridad llevan a decir: este país no tiene derecho al arma nuclear, no tiene derecho a determinados componentes de defensa, porque su naturaleza es tal o tal otra. Bueno, hay que cambiar la totalidad y, desde luego, en un juego racional, eso sería lo más oportuno para la región, pero hay que pensar que, insisto, tener una estrategia es tener una respuesta para lo peor, y lo peor sería que se mantuviera la adopción de la superioridad como criterio en vez de la criterio de equilibrio.
Muchas gracias. Si las armas nucleares son sobre todo un arma política, y lo son, se entiende que la mejor forma de disuasión o de avanzar en la disuasión nuclear es avanzar en la solución de las causas que generan la inseguridad y que llevan a los países, evidentemente, a hacerse con ellas. Y yo creo que en el último medio siglo, en Oriente Medio, hemos tenido dos experiencias que sirven de ejemplo. Una es la de Sadat, que en un acto de valor da el primer paso hacia la paz con Israel y abre una ventana de esperanza en una zona, y se juega la vida y le cuesta la vida en manos de un extremista egipcio, y en segundo lugar Isaac Rabin, que hace lo mismo con el proceso de Oslo y le cuesta la vida en manos de un extremista judío. Yo siempre he pensado, cuando se estaba escuchando, si surgirá un tercer hombre valiente, ¿no?, capaz desde Irán o desde otro país árabe de dar otro paso y que no se juegue la vida en el intento, porque eso sí que sería un avance espectacular hacia la disuasión y hacia la solución de los dos focos que se han dicho hoy en todo el día como los más graves en el tema nuclear, uno de esos dos, para empezar a andar por el buen camino. Bueno, gracias a Vladimir Orlov, Bruno Tertre, José María Ridao y Lores Kor, y mañana sigue el trabajo, creo que a las 10, ¿no? Muchas gracias. Ah, que tenemos, sí, al director del Centro Nacional de Inteligencia, que no pudo venir hoy y estará mañana con nosotros.